Welcome to the 12th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And on the day of Brian Lara's birthday, welcome to the podcast that keeps breaking records. And with the county championship now firmly underway, we've decided that it's all too easy to be sitting here in our little flat of a stone's throw from Lords, criticising what's going on down there. And we decided we're going to get our hands dirty, get into the thick of it, and do nothing else but join the Telegraph Fantasy Cricket League.
I thought at that point when you said get your hands dirty, you were going to announce that you were in fact going to sign up for Middlesex for the season ahead. You were in fact going to be playing the game.
Oh, so that's happening too. And there'll be a full blow-by-blow report
just to reassure you that there's no product placement involved here. We joined the Telegraph Fantasy Cricket League because I was pretty sure it was the only fantasy cricket league there was, although I've now been informed to the contrary, but that's not the case. So I should mention in the interest of fairness that Cricket Info do a very good one as well.
A very good one too. And probably other good ones
probably,
as well.
Probably lots of good
ones.
We don't endorse the Daily Telegraph in any way.
To the business in hand.
Well, let's start with the batsman. Toby, who did you pick?
Well, there's always this difficulty when picking a team, which is that you always want to try and pick a coherent team.
Do you want to think
to yourself, so I go with Sehwag and some other dashing batsman, a Matthew Hayden as your opener. Therefore, you want a slightly steadier number three.
I think that's the true cricket lover's approach to fantasy cricket, isn't it?
When doing fantasy cricket, you have to actually completely disregard the idea of a coherent team, and it's simply a group of individuals who can do their best. So the first name on my team sheet was James Hildreth for Somerset.
He's been a run machine for a while, hasn't he?
For 4 or 5 years now, and his name's been repeatedly associated with England, but England seemed to repeatedly ignore him.
Are you concerned by Somerset slightly disastrous start to the season?
Yeah, well, there is that interesting in the first game when Marcus Escothick, big show of confidence. Can't remember who it is against, but he put whoever it was into bat.
Oh, put Warwickshire, didn't he, into bat?
Warwickshire into bat, and they made 600 odd. And then everyone thought, oh, it's fine, it's a taunt, and this Somerset batting lineup will get 900 in response. And of course, they ended up losing by an innings. It's been quite nice that to an extent Somerset have bounced back with a 9-wicket victory over Hampshire.
And it is early days, isn't it? I mean, it's more than time.
It's early days, and I think Hildreth has proven himself over a while.
So who is next? Who's your number two?
I've then got Michael Carberry and Neil McKenzie. Two old hands. Neil McKenzie, the South African, full of superstition, apparently tapes his bat at the ceiling of the changing room before he goes out to bat.
That's a very odd thing to do, and presumably quite difficult as well. I mean, that must require a large amount of tape to get a bat to stick to the changing room ceiling.
His expenses bill is probably quite
you know, if it works.
But there are two old hands who are going to be, and actually, when I say two old hands, there's another old hand in my side, Vikram Solanki. Who never made it on the test scene for England, but became a pretty regular fixture in the one days for a while.
He had also a real reputation in the one days as a real stylist, didn't he? A great player to watch.
Absolutely.
I mean, his name has sort of slipped out the reckoning a bit of late. But his pedigree is certainly pretty assured.
Yeah.
And certainly at county level.
And there's always this question of whether, if against the lesser bowlers, someone like him always has the opportunity to really cash in against the second change.
I mean, just going back to Carberry as well, he's a player who, talking about, you know, he's been very much mentioned around the England team again and again and again without really. I mean, he got his chance in Bangladesh, didn't he? But he's not had a chance. Yeah. So, he's another player who it's probably now or bust, isn't it, in terms of England?
Exactly. But going to the other side of the world, as it were. Khawaja is my last batsman, who's coming across to play for Derbyshire for the first half of the season.
And the Telegraph, I was astonished by his low value. You could pick him up for just two points,
which was exactly really, it's a scale of 1 to 10 being the most expensive.
Yeah, and I mean, that was the bat. I mean, to give the context, I mean, Hildreth is an 8-point batsman, isn't he?
He's a 9-point batsman.
A 9-point batsman.
Khawaja is a 2, which is particularly after the fame that surrounded his 31 and 22 or whatever it was on his test debut in the Ashes. So those are my glorious batsmen. Which bowlers would you be putting out to trouble them?
Which bowlers?
Mm.
Oh, I would have... Well, I like the look of James Harris. I mean, he's been very much... You know, a great young thing, a great young prospect over the last couple of years.
He suddenly burst onto the team, and
you know, astonishingly young as well, to be having this much success already. Also not a bad lower order batsman as well, has made quite a few savvy sort of lower order contributions at Glamorgan. And I just think, again, it's always worth thinking about, I think, with these fantasy team picks, about the division, because I can't help feeling at Division 2 level, Harris will continue to take an awful lot of wickets, will continue to kick on. But he was really the great young thing in terms of my bowling lineup. Other than him, it was all sort of savvy old pros. We've got Matthew Hoggard there from Leicestershire. I mean, you know, so cruelly discarded by England after that New Zealand series.
Now seems to be taking on a new lease of life with the captaincy as well. It's interesting, there was an article in the last month's Wisden Cricketer, an interview with him, and the interviewer was pointing out the fact that, you know, he has this image of a kind of a bit of a shambolic farmer, but actually, if you talk to, for instance, Michael Vaughan about him, he'll say that actually he's tactically a very astute cricketer.
Well, I think it often takes people by surprise that when everyone talks about Harmison, they talk about Flintoff, they even sometimes sort of talk more about someone like Simon Jones, but yeah. I mean, Hoggard's role in England's success, I mean, was so pivotal. I mean, he's very high up there on the all-time wicket
list. He doesn't seem to have been, having been sort of dismissed out of hand by the England side, as he was against after the New Zealand series a couple of years ago. He doesn't seem to have been content just to go back and be a county trundler. He really looks if he wants to change things, and he's
taken a tough job at Leicestershire. I mean, a very young side with, I think, real potential. I'll be talking about another one of their young hot prospects in a moment. But he's also the kind of player who I think can get old with some success, actually.
Yep.
He never bowled at lightning, rip-roaring pace, so I think he'll do a good job. I mean, Graham Onions was one of my other choices at Durham. Come back from injury, I mean, really cruelly lost to the England setup at a time when things were just really coming right for him. You know, had a decent role to play in that Ashes series in 2007. He bowled well in South Africa with actually limited reward, I thought. I thought it was one of those genuine cases where his figures really didn't reflect how well he bowled. He's come back into the Durham side, instant success. I think because of the queue in front of him in the England lineup, he's going to be playing a lot of cricket for Durham.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think he'll have a very big summer.
And Durham just one of those clubs that are always... Well, I say always successful, have been very successful over the last few years, and you can think, you can sense that can only really
help. And he's well backed up. They've got some other good seamers there. I mean, my final bowling choice, I had Ryan Sidebottom, again on this subject of sort of old savvy pros.
England rejects.
England rejects, as back at Yorkshire, having gone off to Nottinghamshire for a couple of years. I mean, again, a player who knows his game so well. Again, a player who doesn't need massive pace.
And he's quite interesting because he spent so long on the county circuit before he then played for England. I mean,
He got his sort of call up to the England setup very, very late, didn't he?
And so he knows county cricket better than anyone, sure.
Very well. And I thought, again, at 4 points, he seemed very good value. I mean, you can certainly expect him to take wickets this year. What did your bowling attack look like?
My bowling attack, well, I also went with Matthew Hoggard for much the same reason.
I think he may be the only one we both agreed on, which...
He is the only one.
Which is an interesting...
Which is interesting. We obviously are at odds about these kind of things. I went for two overseas players, actually. Chaminda Vaas, who I talked a little bit about in the last episode of Rural Seven Radio. He has not been playing for Sri Lanka as much as he would have liked of late, but he's one of those players, again like Hoggard and Sidebottom, as we were saying, who ages very well. He's got a lot of nous. He never relied on out-and-out pace, and actually his lower order runs, I think, are going to come.
I can't help feeling, again, it's worth looking at the fact that he's bowling for Northants in the second division. I think he will have a lot of success against weaker batsmen.
Yep, exactly.
And, you know, again, that experience as well, you can't really put.
Now, an English born and bred for my next choice, James Tomlinson, at...
This was an interesting one. Left field pick.
Hampshire, who burst onto the scene with a couple of remarkable spells at the beginning of last season. Well, I think he took an 8 wicket haul in innings in one of the first matches. And he's been on the scene. I think he's a good 26, 27, 28 now. But he's tall, he's bouncy, he always seems to have a little something that troubles batsmen. And I just think, I mean, he was for a while associated with the England side, but I don't think he is anymore, and probably doesn't deserve to be anymore. But I think he's one of those people who is a genuinely good county cricketer, rather than being a wannabe international cricketer. And then my last one was actually another overseas choice, Tsobe from South Africa, who we haven't seen a huge amount of, but looks promising. And at 5 points, I thought, well, you know,
an interesting gamble.
Tsobe,
I remember in the run-up to the World Cup, South Africa had that series with India,
yep.
And he did make quite a name for himself in that series amongst some much more sort of highly thought-of bowlers. He did make quite a name for himself. Again, playing at second division level. No, it will be interesting to see what he does there at Essex.
Now, who were your batsmen?
Well, we were talking about Leicestershire and, you know, Matthew Hoggard, the challenge he's got there. James Taylor is the bright young thing, I think, of English cricket at the moment. You know, still very young, appears to be dealing with sort of the pressure that comes with all the expectation he's generated very well.
He's a bit of a Harris, actually, from your bowling attack as well. They're similar types of trajectories in terms of the way they burst onto.
They really have sort of burst onto, and I think Taylor finds himself really carrying quite a heavy burden at Leicestershire. I mean, they're a lot of inexperience in that side. They have struggled really recently. So he's carrying that burden, and I think he'll really kick on this year. I think he'll have another very big year, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him in the England reckoning sometime soon. On the subject of England reckoning, I mean, Ravi Bapara, he's really getting to that point where he's no longer the bright young thing.
Yep.
25 years of age now, I think. He's at that point where if another year or so goes by without England calling...
He might well have lost his...
He'll have lost it. Another, you know... I do apologise, by the way, if you appear to be hearing massive sort of calamity on the road outside.
It's not us. Yeah. We can hasten to say.
Lots of exciting ambulances rushing past. But Bapara... I feel will have a big year this year. He needs to stake his case. He's already made a good start this season for Essex, and I'm sure he'll go on. Got Rory Hamilton-Brown in there. I mean, Hamilton-Brown does seem to hark back to a sort of previous era. He's kind of...
He does
appear to be. He's kind of got that. I mean, his batting is very, very cavalier.
Yeah.
He's had that added responsibility of being given the captaincy of Surrey at such a young age. I feel like he's got the potential. He's certainly got the ability to kick on.
Surrey haven't had a great start to the season.
No.
What I slightly worried about with them making Hamilton Brown captain was that it would all be very well because they do have a good core of players. And they were seen as possibly being... contenders this year, but they've had a disastrous last season.
Two draws and a defeat. They find themselves bottom, and I think it's a fair point to say. I mean, Hamilton Brown is so closely linked to Chris Adams, the coach. I mean, Adams really staked his reputation on making Hamilton Brown captain, on taking a gamble at a time when he wasn't the safe option. I mean, I don't know if Ramprakash wanted the job, but there was certainly safer options.
It'll be interesting to see how Hamilton Brown reacts to that kind of pressure of being and without having had the experience of being in that kind of position.
It's certainly a lot for a young batsman to handle. I mean, my final pick of the batsman, I went for Kane Williamson, not for entirely dissimilar reasons to you going for Khawaja. I mean, I think he's a fantastic young talent. I mean, I think mentioned in the last podcast, I mean, I think he's the standout young prospect in Test cricket at the moment. I think he's a wonderful young talent who shows great temperament as well as great ability. And again, for 3 points seemed like a bargain. Gloucestershire will be a challenge. Again, a county with limited resources. You know, they will be expecting him to do an awful lot of work there. They'll be expecting a lot of runs.
But he's certainly, from what we've seen in the World Cup and in the series against India is yeah, as you say, a lot of raw talent.
Yeah, and a player I think is very serious about making the best of his ability. I think you'll be exciting to see him go. Yep. Now, who did you go for your wicketkeeper pick?
Well, the wicketkeeper's quite interesting because everyone seemed an absolute bargain.
Yeah, it was. You were spoilt for choice here, weren't you?
You were spoilt for choice, and I went for James Foster at Essex, a good batsman and an even better glovesman, who has been making quite a lot of runs in the last couple of seasons. He seems to have actually have done better since being counted out of the England reckoning.
Yeah. I think it almost relaxes him, the fact that he knows he is now, his responsibility is with his county rather than making the case to England.
And then there was one other section which was the all-rounder section. You could either go for one or two all-rounders. And I went for just the one, and I went for Ajmal Shahzad, who... again, I mean, it seems a little bit as if we've, although glancing back at my list, maybe it's not the case. I thought for a moment it seems a little bit as if we've just been picking teams out of England rejects or England hopes.
Yeah.
But there certainly have been a few genuine county players, as it were. And Ajmal Shahzad is one of those people who is a big England hopeful, having not played a test against the Aussies this winter. He really, I mean,
he emerged from the World Cup with his reputation enhanced, didn't
Absolutely.
He? Whereas
and
very few
that spell
players
against,
did. Bangladesh, was it?
Was it against Bangladesh? Yes, exactly, where there were three absolute jaffers that he bowled. And he has obviously got... He's absolutely brimming with raw talent, and he can...
And obviously that extraordinary moment, that six against India.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone for... Similarly, I found myself spoilt for choice with the keepers. I've gone for Stephen Davis at Surrey. Just a wonderful stroke player. Scores run so freely and so quickly. I think Surrey's season will pick up, and I think even if it doesn't, Davis is likely to do quite well. I went for the two all-rounders selection, so had took one batsman less. I've kind of put a lot of my eggs in a sort of Adil Rashid shaped basket. He's 9 points, which I think makes him as expensive as anyone in the game,
which is interesting.
And I've made him my captain, so I've spent a lot of points. And that, I mean, the feeling with
and that, having him as your captain means that you get double the points.
I mean, I think you inevitably slightly pick players that you like in this, don't you? You pick players you want to do well. And I think, frankly, that's been reflected in both our sessions. I love Rashid as a young leg spinner in England. I think that's exciting. I think his sort of mixed start to his England career has led us to forget the fact he is a real talent. And again, sort of the subject of sort of where they are compared to the England squad, Samit Patel, who has one of the most interesting relationships, I think, with the England management. I've gone for him as my other all-rounder. You know, I think he'll score runs, and I think he'll chip in a fair few wickets as well. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Patel is that the fact that he's still in the England reckoning, despite everything that's happened, I think is testament to his ability. I mean, the England selectors would love to have him involved, but he's just made it extremely difficult for him. But we will certainly be keeping you informed as to our progress or lack thereof. From the archives, and this week we go back to 2005, but not to the Ashes of that year, but to a rather odd test match that'll probably never be repeated. Australia versus the ICC World 11. I mean, it's odd sort of thinking about it now. You know, the reason, it's interesting to even think of what the reasoning behind this, you know, what was the need to have this? It was known as the Super Series test match.
Well, I suppose it's the this idea of a sort of rest of the world team is every fantasist's dream, being able to, you know, just put all these what-ifs together
into one actual side.
And and what was quite good about this is not only is the rest of the world team a what-if, but actually the Australian team is a bit of a what-if as well, because what I find quite ironic about this match is that Shane Warne and Stuart McGill are playing together.
Which is a rare event.
And McGill actually eventually out-bowls Warne throughout the match.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose worth quickly mentioning, I mean, the ICC World World 11, they pretty much, they covered all Test Nations with the exception of Bangladesh, didn't they? We've got a few representatives. We've got Graham Smith, Sehwag, Dravid, Lara, Callis, Inzamin, Al-Haq. The English contribution, interestingly, comes in the bowlers with Flintoff and Harmison. We've got Boucher as keeper. And then the World 11 goes with two spinners as well, Vittori and Muralitharan. So all Test Nations, barring Bangladesh, represented.
I can't help feeling that there was a thought behind this series, which was just as the IPL started coming onto the scene and 2020 cricket started expanding and becoming truly global, that this was a kind of response to it, to say, hey, we can do the same thing. We can create our Rajasthan Royals or whatever in a Test team.
I mean, we mentioned before, like, the problem, I suppose, is with the lack of an identity of a rest of the World 11, isn't it? I mean, you know, it doesn't have the identity of a select team in rugby, some of those sides like the Lions and the Barbarians and stuff like that. But anyway, to the game itself, we have Australia batting first and sort of getting off to a very poor start, Harmison seeing off Langer with the third ball. But in the end, a Matthew Hayden 100 sets them up respectably well. They go on to make 345.
Supported by a 94 from Adam Gilchrist.
A pacey 94 as well, just off 111 balls. But yeah, one of those sort of odd sort of innings is where a couple of players do a lot and the rest of the side sort of do very little.
It's interesting because you kind of wondered before this match whether this, because obviously this was an Australian side, straight off the back of losing that Ashes series to England. And actually, it's an Australian side which is very, very similar to the one which did lose the Ashes. The only two people in this Australian side are Shane Watson and Stuart McGill, who didn't play in that Ashes series. So you think 3-4-5 after their first innings, it's on a knife edge slightly, do you think?
For the sake of the game, it's quite sort of well poised. I mean, from an English perspective, Flintoff leads the way with the ICC World 11 bowlers taking 4 for 59. It's interesting, you know, in 2005 that this World 11 has got two Englishmen opening the attack. But probably the failure behind this match is really the failure of that World 11 side to put many runs on the board. I mean, that kind of kills it as a contest.
Which is interesting, because actually, if you would have thought which side of the game relies, in a sense, more on individual talent, can be called, sort of brought straight in and doesn't rely on that team identity, perhaps that would be batting. But actually,
they struggle their way to 190, don't they, in response. And I mean, Sehwag makes a sort of a typically Sehwag-ish 76, coming off just 82 balls. We've got 14 fours in there. No one else really goes with him. We've got a useful 44 from Callis. Flintoff chips in with 30-odd. But really, it's a series of failures. The damage is done by the two leg spinners, isn't it?
By Stuart McGill, we're taking 4 for 39 and Warne with 3 for 23 at an incredible economy of 1.91. And wickets fall pretty regularly throughout the innings, and there's just no sort of real dominance from them.
And I mean, you mentioned the what if. I mean, we've got McGill and Warne playing together. They played very rarely together in the Test side. And I mean, the damage they did that day, you know, maybe wasn't interesting, gave food for thought to the Australian selectors.
Where was this game?
It was at Sydney.
It was in Sydney, yeah. Obviously on a real turn.
They obviously fancied it to turn. I mean, the Australian second innings then, they're well poised at this stage. They've got a 160-run lead. And the rest of the World 11 respond fairly well here. Australia dismissed for under 200, having at one point been 150 for one. So there's a pretty massive collapse here. You know, at the stage when it looked like Australia could really bat themselves into safety.
And it's a great turnaround for Muralitharan, who in the first innings takes 2 for 102, and then in the second innings takes 3 for 55. A much, much better economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of Murali's very much involved. Flintoff again, 3 for 48. Harmison 3 for 41. It's a pretty spectacular collapse. I mean, Clark, Catish, Gilchrist all go for single figures.
I wonder whether, I mean, this is a complete nerd thing, but I wonder whether ever before two leg spinners on one side have played against two off spinners on another. Because it's not often you get two spinners on each side, but it's just quite interesting.
Well, I think we're going to have to...
fallen that way. And, yeah. if anyone knows of another game...
Where two off spinners are taken up against two leg spinners. It's nerdy, but interesting. The Australian Claps keeps the game alive as a contest, doesn't it? Because there's a stage there where it looks like, with Hayden and Ponting going well, it looks like Australia can build as big a lead as they want.
But eventually the World 11 only actually need, well, I say only, need 355 victory.
Well, it's tantalising, isn't it? It's a tough chase, but you still think it's chaseable.
Whenever you watch a test match, you always look down the team list and you say, oh, if X is on form, they're going to win it. And you look back and you say, you look down the World 11 and you just say, one of Graham Smith, Virender Sehwag, Raoul Dravid, Brian Lara, Jacques Callis, Ings and Manal Haque all have to make runs. And they'll get very close.
I mean, and sadly, I mean, it's dead as a contest, you feel, by the time they find themselves 70-5.
Yep.
No one makes a score. I mean, Callis top scores with 39. It's all a little bit dismal. It's all a little bit sad. And you wonder...
But 39 not out batting at 5 as well.
Yeah, at a sort of steady Callis rate. Again, I mean, you were quite right. I mean, McGill does out bowl Warne. He picks up 5-43. But again, it's these leg spinners who do the damage. They take 8 wickets between them. You wonder if the concept, this whole World 11 concept, may have had more of a future if this game had simply been a better game.
Yep, exactly. No, it wasn't the most thrilling. After Australia posted a big score, there wasn't really much in it.
I suppose you wonder about the motivation of the players involved. I mean, you talk about there's no lack of quality on that side, but you think chasing 355 with that sheer amount of quality, you know, in the dressing room, you wonder maybe players like Lara and Dravid and whatever, they couldn't summon that same sort of...
And there's this kind of IPL feel about the team, that it's just a ridiculously motley crew of individuals who have been thrown together, just so completely desperate. You wonder whether, you know, actually... The idea of...
I mean, at the time, the players talked the talk about it, the sort of honour, excitement of being involved, but you just wonder, a busy schedule, maybe they didn't maybe take it perhaps as seriously. But anyway, it within the archives, it's certainly a cricketing oddity, isn't it? And as I said, something I think would be very surprised if it's repeated.
Review, and this week we are turning to a book which isn't exclusively about cricket. Ed Smith's What Sport Tells Us About Life. Ed Smith, of course, the Middlesex and very briefly England cricketer, who we have just discovered now writes leaders for the Times, as well as having written this book.
He certainly gained a reputation as... I mean, he made a reputation, obviously, as a cricketer, but his writing has quickly gained him quite a following.
As a proper intellectual, rather than just as a cricketer who's got an interesting story to tell. This is a fascinating collection of essays about all different aspects of sport, drawing examples from here, there and everywhere. On the front cover is a picture of the famous Zidane headbutt.
Which he does attempt to explain, doesn't he, at one point in the book.
Which he does attempt to explain. We're just going to pick up on a few of the essays, but actually one which we're not going to talk about in depth, but it's probably worth just passing over, is the last one in the book called Cricket, C.L.R. James and Marxism, in which he plucks an anecdote from C.L.R. James's Beyond a Boundary, where James's father is called in to mend an engine by the white engineers who don't know how to do it, and C.L.R. James's father, a black man, comes in and does it, but refuses to tell them how he's mended this engine. And it's rather nice little anecdote, and Ed Smith sees it as actually being this. He discusses at length how the vision C.L.R. James has of West Indian cricket is that it is essentially independent. It's something that's learned spontaneously. It's something that's learned by sort of passing down from father to son, rather than MCC handbook.
And something that allows the West Indies to make its own unique mark.
Exactly. But that's just one example of the way that Ed Smith is very, very good at drawing examples which can often seem utterly literary or historical, and making them actually apply.
Well, when you said he pulls things in from everywhere, I mean, I think that's his strength. His knowledge of sport generally is sort of encyclopedic. He pulls things in. And he says, very interesting, at one point in the book, he says he wanted to write a book where you could replace the word sport and actually talk about politics or talk about education. He's using sport as a device, really, to talk about human nature in general. I mean, one of the essays that we've got to talk about on a cricketing podcast, Why There Will Never Be Another Bradman. I mean, this was very much a sports-focused essay. And it comes down to that eternal desire within all sports fans to talk about who was the best, you know, generation to generation. And, I mean, Smith really approaches it. His approach throughout really is academic, and I think that's quite heartening, really, and something slightly different.
But he does treat a topic which can often be treated in a solely sportingly way. He treats it as an academic and as a politician, and as the
case he makes with Bradman, that perhaps isn't entirely new but is certainly very well made, is that the issue with Bradman was not just how good he was but how much better than his peers he was.
Exactly,
he makes the point that particularly the rise of professionalism has particularly led to a big rise in the ability of the average and of the lowest ability player. And consequently, Bradman was able to tower above those players in a way that he suggests simply wouldn't be possible anymore. And it's interesting because I think we instinctively always think, well, how does Bradman compare to the best? Whereas actually what we need to be thinking a little bit more about, what was the gap between Bradman and the ordinary?
And the average one at the time.
Exactly. And the bowlers who he used to...
all time.
Exactly. And I think it was a very interesting point, an interesting indictment of sort of the way professionalism has changed the game. You took an interest in his essay on history, didn't you?
Yeah,
particularly relating it to England's Ashes triumph.
Exactly, and he makes the quite interesting and I think very valid point that it would have been just as worthwhile having a post-mortem after the 2005 Ashes victory than it was after the 2006 Ashes defeat. And this sort of thing of saying, wonderful, we've won, it's all therefore it's all fine and dandy, he actually says that that's completely almost counterintuitive, because what you want to learn from is your success.
His approach is very much academic, and it's not dry academic. He goes through different ways that you can view sporting history, and I think particularly interestingly he draws attention to the way you can often not look at you can look at all the facts involved but not judge which ones are important or not.
Exactly.
And that's a crime that, frankly, sports journalism down the ages, I think, can be accused of. And he also just makes a big case for the what-ifs, doesn't he? He suggests that those counterfactuals...
Yep, and actually that's a very... he makes the case for what-ifs being actually a very valid way of looking at what's important within a match, for instance. So if you could say, what if Glenn McGraw hadn't sprained his ankle... Actually, it's not just a fantasist way of creating a different match.
It's a serious way of assessing the strength of the England side,
exactly.
The strength of Australian side. It's interesting because traditionally those what-ifs we often look upon as sort of a bit of a game, really, for fans to play. I mean, he writes an essay as well on amateurism within sport, and particularly he begins that essay talking about a rather sad incident involving Fred Titmuss, talking about how when he was once announced at Lord's as playing, they had to review the announcement later on because they'd accidentally announced him as a amateur rather than a professional, and they felt the need to put that right. And so he sort of criticises that snobbery that amateurism often entails with cricket. But he then makes a very interesting case. Again, his scheme of reference is so broad. He brings in the Brazilian football coach, Luiz Felipe Scolari, saying that Scolari's belief was that players were so obsessed with what they should be doing with their professionalism that they'd forgotten that amateur love of the game that made them good in the first place.
And that actually is a healthy mix of the two, which is the real ingredient for
exactly
success.
And I think perhaps that this obsessive drive we've had to professionalize sport through the coaching, through the means, there's something to be said for preserving something of an amateur mindset. And I mean, this is one of Smith's strength, I think, is that he makes a case that goes against the flow, doesn't it? I mean, we talk about how the England cricket setup needed to be professionalized, you know, but he makes a case that goes against the flow. I mean, as a book, I think you could recommend it to those who aren't necessarily sports fans per se. I think there's a lot in it.
Absolutely, and it's very satisfying, both in, as we've said repeatedly, its broad range of reference, but also the fact that it's simultaneously very easy to read, but also it does attack this issue of what is important about sport absolutely head on.
And I think it's quite a good book for those who follow sport, who care about sport, and get irritated with those who write it off as irrelevant.
Yep,
it's exactly. quite a good book to give to those people and say, actually, this is something that says a lot about who we are and what we do. From the blogs, and this week we are looking at the 99.94 blog, which promises considered cricket analysis from beyond the boundary. The address is nestorquinn.wordpress.com. I mean, one thing about blogging that I think makes it engaging as a format is the independence bloggers have to do things differently to have their own style. And this blog does have quite a unique sort of way of setting things out. Most of its posts are built around this sort of six ball model. So each post will have six reflections on cricket,
labeled bite-sized.
Yeah, very bite-sized, and it makes it both. I think it works firstly because it's easy to read. You know, it's you can take it in a very short sort of short moment. And I think what I quite like about it is rather than sort of a rambling argumentative post on one thing or another, you get sort of a variety of almost like thought starters, little things to think about.
What's quite interesting is that often, even though they are six fairly independent points, the fact that they're put together into an over, as it were, makes you automatically draw relations
between the
two.
It's an interesting thing. It's a good idea. I mean, just an example on today, we've got something where we've got a couple of pieces on Usman Khawaja, a little thing on the effectiveness of speed guns in sport, a reflection on Scotland's success in the county game. It's nice, in a way, to get so much into a little post. I mean, the piece we were going to focus on is a rather interesting almost tribute piece, isn't it, to over by over commentary.
And this isn't one of the six ball ones.
No, this has got a slightly different.
It's sort of a full blown blog post, but charting the rise of the ball by ball commentary, by both Cricket Info and elsewhere. Something everyone who's been in an office on a summer's afternoon during an Ashes series will know well is that it really is. It's not only the and this is the point that is made in the blog. The iconic status comes not from the fact that it's just a live score update. It's not like just having a scoreboard. The fact that people are going to write in and you get the real sense of a cricket community.
In many ways, without wanting to get too nerdy about it again, I mean, it was real Web 2.0. In action. You've got this system whereby the journalist's writing it, but the journalist is utterly reliant on people contributing. I mean, what I particularly liked about this article is I think it did what any good article, what any good blog post should do, which is draw your attention to something that you haven't really thought about before.
Exactly.
And I realised how we've become so used
really
to over by over.
It's something
we're so used to, but we forget the fact that this is actually a very young format, and it's something that's had ridiculous success. I mean, you say we're all used to it. I think most cricket fans spend a worrying amount of time following over by over.
And you were just saying that The Guardian have just published a book which has
quite bizarrely, they've chosen to publish in full the over by over commentary from the most recent Ashes series, which is a really interesting, it'll be curious to see whether it works. It's a really interesting take on cricket publishing, because really you assume these things are just meant for kind of momentary consumption.
Exactly, but what's quite interesting is that, and I think it's a similar thing with Test Match Special on the radio, that I have at times, and this makes me sound like a complete cricket tragic, I have at times recorded Test Match Special in order to listen back to, well, I haven't been able to listen
that
to
that is one of your grandest tragic admissions.
Vital sessions of the last Ashes, for instance. But what makes it is simply that it's not just sitting in front of a moving scoreboard. It's so much more that's brought in to enrich the whole cricket experience. And as I say, it's that thought of a cricket community of people coming from.
And it's interesting as well that the blog puts it rather nicely when it says, the smart arsery as well as the sort of descriptions. Yep. I mean, I know with the BBC, Ben Dears has built himself quite a cult following. I mean, lots of them have, just by not just giving the description, by giving a bit of life and giving a bit of free form to it. So it's certainly, and I guess we may well have not seen the format develop to its end. I mean, we'll assume new things. But no,
to tie the two together, actually, is that so this is 99.94 creates a eulogy to the Ball by Ball commentary, but actually they're doing a very, very similar thing, which is as all blogs do, this whole sort of community of cricket bloggers, I suppose us too, in a very, very small way, which is creating, combining facts with opinion and creating
something slightly different,
compelling stuff there. To the debate, and this week we asked whether Duncan Fletcher is the man to establish an Indian cricketing dynasty.
I mean, this news came out of left field, really, I think, for all of us. It was an appointment that, you know, obviously a lot of time had been invested within India to make the decision. The gut reaction of a lot of people seems to be that this is an entirely new challenge, something that in no way resembles the job he undertook with England.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, because I was initially pretty sceptical, because I was of the opinion similarly that with the England team that he was bringing out from the late 1990s, he was starting with absolutely nothing, basically, and he brought up for 7 or 8 years up to the 2005 Ashes. But actually, when you think about it, and when you think what India need at the moment is actually, despite the fact that they've just won a World Cup and they're the number, am I right saying they're the number one ranked
they are, nation? Yes, number one test side, yeah.
They are actually, I think, and this may sound bizarre, a team in transition, because they have got an old guard that isn't going to be there for very much longer.
And it's not just, I mean, the core of the squad, the star players, the Tendulkar, the Dravids, the Sehwags, the Laxman, they've all, you know, on the way out. So,
and
I mean,
they've got young talent, and we've discussed this in the past, actually, they've got young talent coming through, and a lot of it, but it's handling that transition in a way that isn't going to create the car crash of what we've seen with Australian cricket, which is where I think that transition has been handled very badly indeed.
I think how you bring those young players through, in a way, the fact that Fletcher has that challenge, it does resemble a bit more of the task he had with England. It is a rebuilding job.
Famously, when he was with England, he culminating in the publication of his autobiography, which I think just annoyed everyone left, right and centre, he's not a good man with the press. Do we think that that's going to translate? I mean, is that just a general inability to do any kind of PR
He disliked and blamed an awful lot of his troubles on the English press. The Indian press has a far worse, a far more intrusive, a far more aggressive reputation. Yeah. The expectations are even higher. That being said, Fletcher's older, he's wiser, and also he knows what to expect. So I would imagine it won't be the side of the job he enjoys, but he'll come up with a way to deal with it.
And usually he knows how to hide behind his dark glasses.
We'll probably be seeing a fair bit of hiding. I mean, one point that I haven't seen discussed much is generally what the response within the Indian camp will be. Some ex-players, I think, have been a little bit disappointed that there wasn't an Indian appointment, which you can see why. I mean, for a nation of its size, of its cricketing stature, there is a feeling, I think, that it would be great to have an Indian running cricket in India.
But often, dare I say, maybe it needs someone who isn't from inside the cricketing establishment and associated with some of the infighting powers that goes on.
I think an outsider certainly does have a lot of advantages. I mean, the other thing that keeps coming out about Fletcher is his ability to break down the technique of an individual batsman.
Yeah, absolutely. Technician.
I mean, do you reckon that will come into play with
the
decision?
It's going to be interesting because if there's one thing that this Indian team can pride itself on, it's his batting, and it's got batting mentors galore in the shape of particularly Dravid and Tendulkar to bring on the next generation. But certainly there is something very strong about his nuts and bolts approach to the technical side of things, which I think, I mean, for any team can only be.
And perhaps some of those young batsmen coming in, I mean, I'm really thinking of the Kohlis, the Pujaras, you know, perhaps he can play a role in sort of moving them on. I mean, straight up kind of, you know, not quite yes or no, but I mean, do you think it'll be a success? He's not expected to be there for a long time. We're talking about a relatively short-term appointment. Do you see it being a success?
Well, I just can't see Duncan Fletcher not having undertaken this without the conviction that he can make a success of it, and I think very often Duncan Fletcher knows when he can do that.
And there is this small sense of unfinished business. He achieved so much with England, but actually it wasn't the finale he quite wanted. There was that horrible final Ashes series. There was that horrible final World Cup.
So perhaps he'll rise again with the Indian side.
Perhaps there is still a point to prove with him. Well, thank you for sticking with us back again. We hope to be with you in a couple of weeks' time. We've got to work around Toby's Chinese engagements. If the Chinese government are listening, I can assure you Toby is intending to lead a Jasmine revolution in
your country. And I'm very much looking forward to teaching the Chinese to play. Although, actually, I was reading an interesting article that apparently the Chinese do play a bit of cricket.
With limited success, I would imagine.
So maybe next time we'll have a special
report. Next time we will have an in-depth report, Toby Chan, on the future of Chinese cricket. We'll see you then.